I'm trying to think of the reader, and what does the reader want in terms of understanding what all this means? Also, not just focusing on what might appear like dire consequences, but finding what might be the positive side. Venezuela has been deteriorating economically, socially, politically for the past couple of decades. And so, you know, might this shock over time with the right management and the right steps, sort of enlightened steps, actually allow Venezuela to return to the much more prosperous and stable country that it had been?
That's Howard LaFranchi. The Monitor's U.S.-based diplomacy correspondent since 2001, Howard's had a career as a globetrotter. In recent years, he's been a key part of our rotation of writers into Ukraine. He's worked out of Paris and Baghdad. Howard was also the Monitor's Mexico City-based Latin America correspondent from 1994 to 2001. He traveled repeatedly to Venezuela before and during the rise of Hugo Chavez. All of that and his knack for smart, context-rich distillation put Howard on the short list of writers to tap when Monitor editors began looking at how to size up the Trump administration's arrest and extraction of Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro earlier this month and its declared intent to run Venezuela, a story that jolted our editorial staff, which was just coming off a holiday break. This is Why We Wrote This. I'm Clay Collins. Howard joins me today. Hey, Howard.
Hey, good to talk, Clay.
So the dust is settling a bit now, but let's go back to the early hours of January 3rd. Operation Absolute Resolve unfolds in Caracas. The hemisphere is shook, right? This is gunboat diplomacy. The big stick is back. It's the Don Roe Doctrine, as the president called it at one point. I want to get into the particulars of the story you wrote that weekend, which got at the deeper meaning. But first, I just want to know, where were you when you heard about the operation? And did you kind of take a beat and think, whoa, or did you immediately start thinking about sources?
As you noted, most of us were just kind of getting up and getting our day going. I'm not one who has my phone right by my bed. So I was downstairs, happened to look over at my phone. I was picking it up and it said I had an incoming call from our managing editor, Kurt Schillinger. And I thought, oh, that's probably a mistake, but I'll pick it up anyway. And I got a rather grave sounding Kurt saying, Howard, can you join the call that we're all on right now? Mm-hmm. I didn't want to sound ignorant, frankly. So I just said, sure, give me a minute. Got off that call, checked the news very quickly, saw what had happened, and then joined the Zoom call with editors and writers. Really, for a number of months with the military buildup in the Caribbean.
In Armada, really.
Yes, at least 20% of U.S. naval capacity in the Caribbean. You don't do that simply to send a message to, in this case, Nicolas Maduro to change his ways. Many of us thought something was coming. Also, we have to take into consideration we're dealing with Donald Trump here. We know that he likes to make decisions kind of off the cuff, which in this case, very impressive operation. I mean, it took a huge amount of planning. Nevertheless, I think for all of us, there was kind of a whoa, as you say, and then here we go.
Right. So clearly not a butt dial from the managing editor and a president whose brand is unpredictability. So yeah, it's off to the races, right? We talk in our business a lot about first day stories and then going on from there. You know, in this case, we had three writers led by Whitney Ulick and with a contribution by a fourth writer produce an excellent story by Saturday afternoon. It was mostly on the flashbang of the event and the early thinking that it stirred around things like legality and geopolitics. But by then, you're already in motion on a follow-up story.
Yes, you know, what we call second day stories. Mm-hmm. It relates to Trump's own pronouncement since the very first days of the second term that he would be implementing a sort of updated version, a more aggressive version of the Monroe Doctrine, perhaps taking back the Panama Canal, his interest in Greenland. In the initial days, there wasn't any talk of Venezuela that I recall. And so in March, I produced a magazine cover story on, you know, the new Monroe Doctrine based on a trip to Peru and then a lot of conversation with experts and, as far as I could, officials from the administration.
Right.
So there was some preparation, some background for the story that we did, kind of the first second day story.
Right. There was that story. I think you and Whitney collaborated a bit on that. And then you ended up writing, you know, just this past weekend about the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine over the early 1820s. And you cited the 1904 Roosevelt Doctrine. I want to send listeners to your story by way of a link in our show notes. But just to encapsulate what's going on, this is essentially another might makes right moment for the United States, correct? And now Greenland seems like a big hemispheric shoe that might drop.
Yes. Again, the president has been talking about Greenland since the first days of this second term, and now he is reemphasizing that and causing all kinds of uproar in transatlantic relations.
Denmark being a NATO country.
Denmark being a NATO country, and the prime minister of Denmark saying any moves by the United States against Denmark would signal the end of NATO. So
right.
The repercussions of this cannot be underestimated. And that sort of gets into the next second day story, you might say, mm-hmm. that I'm working on. Is this a new era of, you know, law of the jungle?
Right. Like, you know, Putin wants Ukraine, she wants Taiwan. I mean, is it kind of power dictates?
Yes. You know, also, is it the end of an order since World War II that certainly gave Europe, which for centuries had been, you know, the seat of conflict one after the other, mm-hmm. a U.S.-led global order based on international law and U.S.-led alliances, at the top of the list being NATO. Hmm. Yes, there have been conflicts, but nothing even near the order of a World War II. So again, the question is, how damaging are these moves by the United States that much of the world is decrying as leading to a new instability?
Right. I want to pull us back to Latin America, because obviously the U.S. has a long history of actions down there, too. And you're an old Latin America hand, Howard. You've got this hip pocket context that comes with layers and layers. I'm not trying to make you feel senior here, but a lot of lived history, right, in that region. And there's so much context here. The internet channels right after the U.S. extraction were flooded, including with speculation, you know, about the possible involvement of third parties, about secret deals. There were these comparisons to Panama and Manuel Noriega in the late 80s. So basically, you need to respond to the news and not to others' reactions to the news. So my question is, how do you stay focused on what's actually known?
With this president, it's difficult to know what is known and to set out with a basic set of facts. You know, I think to the press conference President Trump held on Saturday, January 3rd, and the president already was talking about how the United States was going to be running Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And there in the background was Secretary Rubio with this struck look on his face like, wait, what? We are?
Right, right.
So I must admit, in that moment, I thought, well, if this is news to the Secretary of State, how can I be expected to know, you know, what's coming forward? But that very unpredictability leads to all this speculation. And I think that's probably part of the intent mm-hmm. to worry people. I mean, you also may recall that at that very first press conference at Mar-a-Lago, Secretary Rubio said, if I were Havana, referring to the Cuban government, but right. if I were Havana, I'd be worried. So I think the intent is to send the shockwave through the region. But I think underneath it all, the message is that the days of the United States, of America, paying for the defense and the stability of the rest of the world are over. And now we're going to be pursuing a foreign policy, specifically in our hemisphere, that serves first and foremost U.S. interests and assures that other countries and leaders in the region are on board with that agenda.
I'm interested in pursuing this idea of kind of how you know what to pursue. Some of it's reading body language, as you say. Talk about when it's important to be on the ground when possible versus when it works to be in a quieter perch, sort of remotely executing news analysis. And also maybe explain to listeners how feeds from other reporters can add important voices and capture a local mood.
I must admit, as I was preparing my first story on January 3rd, I had that reporter's itch, wow, I wish I could be on the ground in Caracas.
Do you have a go bag by any chance?
I do not, although I pack much differently now from the early days, certainly of covering Latin America. A little anecdote. So my first overseas reporting job was in Paris. That involved a lot of press conferences at the Elysee or getting up to Brussels for NATO meetings. So there was a lot of suits and ties involved. And then I get to Latin America, and my first reporting trip to Cuba, had a meeting with one of the deputy foreign ministers. He greets me in his guayabera, and I was wearing a sport jacket. And so at the end of our meeting, he said, "Oh, and Howard, next time, lose the jacket, okay?" But you pack differently for each assignment. For Ukraine, for example, Ukraine's president is not a guy who likes a coat and tie, so I don't have to worry about packing a suit. But we do have to be very mindful of the security situation. The drone warfare means that really you're at risk almost anywhere. And we have a security bag that we take in with us, a heavy armored vest, helmet, first aid kit, of course, but then also communication equipment. I think it's important to try to do both. The analysis story is for readers' understanding of what may be coming, what this means. The human story, the on the ground, how does this impact you? If I look back over my career, it's those human stories that I remember, whether it was Colombia, Cuba, Ukraine. At the moment, it's not easy to get into Venezuela. I know of a number of reporters who are stuck on the Colombian border, waiting to try to get in. And for those who were already on the ground, I've heard about some detentions of foreign reporters just for a few hours, but I think signal sending by the Venezuelan authorities on the ground.
And of course, sometimes it's possible to get in-country reporters, native Venezuelans in this case, but they are also at risk. And so that has to be handled, I assume, very, very carefully in terms of protecting them in assisting you with getting color from inside.
Yeah. So if you have established relationships on the ground, you can have a better chance anyway of citing those sources. But in some cases, given the situation, people just, they're willing to talk to you, but not for attribution.
Right.
So you just go with that.
So Howard, more stories of yours will have run before this episode airs. But as we speak here, without giving away the store, what are some angles that you're considering? And more important, I guess, can you describe the kind of monitor thinking that helps inform monitor angles in particular?
Yes. Where are we going with the global order? What countries or organizations might try to fill a void if a void were left by the U.S. relinquishing its role as global leader? So that's one area. I think also an additional focus on Latin America, on the region, for example, Colombia, which, you know, we have very strong relations or have had very strong relations with Colombia going way back to the 90s when we were investing heavily in what then was called Plan Colombia. That involved drug trade issues, narco trafficking. It was also the U.S. siding with the Colombian government to bring stability to a country that had been the seat of guerrilla warfare for decades. And so now we have a turn there, too, where the United States seems to be taking on a more aggressive policy. I think all of us at the Monitor, but I certainly am trying to think of the reader. And what does the reader want in terms of understanding what all this means? Also, not just focusing on what might appear like dire consequences, but finding what might be the hopeful or positive side. Venezuela has been deteriorating economically, socially, politically for the past couple of decades. And so, you know, might this shock over time with the right management and the right steps, sort of enlightened steps, actually allow Venezuela to return to the much more prosperous and stable country that it had been in the past? And I think that Venezuelans, especially Venezuelans who are now outside their country, but Venezuelans wanting to return, for many of them, we're hearing that there is this sense of hope that, terrible as this might be right now, maybe there is some good and some progress for the future. We try to not just leave readers with the upheaval, but actually where these shocks might allow for progress.
Mm-hmm. So much in play in the hemisphere and indeed in the world. Thank you, Howard, for being on top of this remarkable story and for breaking it down, as always, in ways that are both clear and calm.
Thanks, Clay.
And thanks to our listeners. You can find links to the story you just heard discussed and to all of Howard's reporting in our episode show notes at csmonitor.com/whywerotethis. This episode was hosted by me, Clay Collins, and produced by Jingnan Peng. Mackenzie Farkas is also a producer on this show. Our sound engineer was Alyssa Britton. Original music is by Noel Flatt. Produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2026.